Victor, yes, last week said we should talk about the ego. I do have a CD. I had talked about it about a year ago, but each time you talk about the same subject, you get different ideas. So, ego is a very good subject to discuss because I think the main problem in our spiritual journey is the ego. That is the main obstacle. The main obstacle in my path to reaching the higher is the ego. So, question is, what is the ego? In this chart, as we all know, the body, the mind, and the intellect is my equipment, and the world consists of objects, emotions, and thoughts. The relationship between my equipment and the world, which is called the perceiver, feeler, thinker, is also said to be the ego. Because I think myself to be this limited perceiver, feeler, and thinker, and with that attitude, I work in the world, so I use my equipment of body, mind, and intellect and interact with the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts, and don't pay any attention to the self or the consciousness. And under the pressure of the vasanas, our selfish desires, I just constantly work. And so that is called the ego. Ego is also said to be part of the subtle body because our subtle body consists of four components. One is the mind, which is the seat of emotions. Also, the mind is where the impulse first arises. Like if I see a glass, impulse goes to the mind and the mind says, I'm thirsty. So then, you pick up the glass and drink it. Or if you see something unpleasant, somebody I don't like, then the mind says, I don't like this person, let's get out of here. So the mind is where the first impulse is met. The intellect is what decides what is right, what is wrong, what I should do, what I should not do. So the mind, the intellect are two aspects of the subtle body. There are four. The third one is called chitta or memories. The sum total of all my memories, my memory bank is the third aspect. And the fourth one is the ego. So how does the ego manifest? So as we said, ego is this sense of I am this perceiver, feeler, and thinker, and it's part of the subtle body. How does the ego manifest? It manifests as I and mine. Because when I think that I am this limited individuality and I am this body, mind, and intellect, then immediately who am I? I am this limited ego, this limited person, and mine. So this is mine, and this is yours, and this is. But if it is yours, it should become mine. So that is how we work in this world. Your money I should get, or your land I should get, or your country I should, as it's happening all over the world. So this I and mine results in a doership. Doership means I did it. The moment this I did it comes, then all the problems arise. If things go well, I am so great, I am so successful, I am so wonderful. And if things don't go well, I am so miserable, I'm a useless creature, I'm worthless. I get depressed, I go to the psychiatrist, take medicines. Or on the other hand, I'm elated, I'm the greatest, I'm the best, there is nobody like me. Nobody could have done it like I did. So immediately the I and mine comes. Now, what is the problem? What is wrong with, okay, it's my house or my car or my wallet or my money. What's wrong with that? And people say you must have self-esteem, you must have self-confidence. So when you say there is no I or mine, does that mean I should have no self-confidence, or I should not have any self-esteem, or I should not have a sense of doership? If I did something well, is it not okay to be happy? And if things didn't go well, is it not okay? It is, but constantly living in this I and mine leads to desire and sorrow. Because like I said, you know, I own this business, but now I need to grow the business. So what do? There's a business across town. I either buy it out or I, you know, reduce my prices to put them out of business, so I can be the sole monopoly in the town, you know. So it leads to unhealthy competition. You say, what's wrong with having desires? You know, I mean, we all have desires. We have a desire to eat. We have a desire to wear nice clothes. You want to buy a car. You want to have some money. But the problem with having desires is that desire has no end. The moment you fulfill one desire, another desire is ready. I fulfilled one, and then either I want more of that, I want to repeat that, like I enjoyed ice cream, then I want more of that, or I had a pleasant experience, I want to repeat it, or I'm satisfied with one, now I want something else. I'm bored of, you know, this wife, or I'm bored of this situation, or I'm bored of this job. So desires, the head of our missions, Swami Tejomayananda, says desire is like a box of Kleenex. You know, you take one and the other one is ready. You pull one and the other. So it's like that. You fulfill one desire, another desire comes up. So the desire A has no end, number one. Number two, the second problem with desires is that, okay, even if your desire got fulfilled, is it permanently fulfilled? No, because say you get attached to somebody and okay, you married her. But then, you know, the situations change. Either she will change or you will change or your relationship will change or other factors will come in. And same thing with an object. You know, I'll have a new car or I have a new this. Sooner or later, things become old. You know, I cannot always get the same amount of joy as I got, you know, the new car smell. But after 6 months or a year or two, you say, I'm bored of this car. I want a new car. So either the car changes, goes down, or your mind changes. You say, you know, it's enough of this. I want a sports car. You know, I when I reach my 40s and 50s, then you get the midlife crisis, then you go out and buy a Corvette, you know. So the objects do not give you permanent joy. And also, the desire keeps multiplying, keeps growing. And that's why Mahatma Gandhi said, there is enough in this world for everybody's needs. But there is not enough in this world to fulfill even one man's want. When I want, the wants are, you know, endless. Needs are limited. So that is the problem with desire. And then how does desire lead to sorrow? First of all, as I said, desire leads to competition. I want this, and other person also, 10 people want the same thing. Only one is going to get it. 9 people are going to be left with sorrow. And as I said, I keep on multiplying my desires. I want more and I want more. And when finally there comes a stage where I can't get it, you say, then we tell God, you know what? I wanted this and you didn't even give it to me. I went to church Sunday and what is this? God says, you know, all these years I have been giving you stuff and you have reached this stage. We forget about that, all what he has done. But the one thing I didn't get. Because our relationship with God is like a business. Okay, I go to church, in return you give me this, or you bless me with this. Second problem with sorrow is, if you look in the world right now, what is the problem? Why is there so much conflict in Ukraine and in the Middle East and all the places, war in Africa and all? Why? Because of ego. In Ukraine, maybe Putin's ego, you know, the one guy's ego, or either it's an individual ego or it's a national ego. You know, the ego of one community or ego of one race. And that leads to all the wars and conflicts. So the ego doesn't only have to be an individual ego. It can be a nation's ego, where the nation thinks that I need to get this to become complete. So it leads to sorrow. Somebody translated ego as E-G-O, edging God out. how does ego arise? Because we say God is everything. Everything emerged from him. God alone is the whole universe. the scriptures say that, but I don't see that. I don't see God. I see her as different from her and him, and then this one is my friend and this one is my enemy. So, but why did that happen? Why did the ego arise? How did the ego arise? You know, why did this relationship end? So they say the ego arises out of superimposition. What happens is that, how does the ego arise? See, the body is there. We all have the body, right? And we all have this consciousness, the life principle. You can call it God or Atman or Brahman. Now, between the consciousness and the body arose this structure called ego. Now, they say it's very interesting. Ego, what does, when I say ego, that means I think I am this body. That is ego, right? That I think I am this body. I am not the consciousness, but I am this body. That is the ego. Now, how did that arise? Consciousness and body, how did they get connected? In between arose this perceiver, feeler, thinker called ego, which gets, the ego apparently is alive, right? Ego is not dead, appears to be alive. So the ego gets life from the consciousness. And how does it get shape? It gets shape from the body. So the ego gets a structure called the body. And how does the ego get life? From consciousness. So in between consciousness and this body arises this sense of ego. If the ego was not there, and if I was only identified with the consciousness, and then I was using the body as an equipment, then I would have no problem. Then there would not be I and mine, there would, because then you would not be edging God out, because you would be one with God. And we'll talk a little more about that in the end. So they say it is a superimposition where the world is nothing but that consciousness, but on it I superimpose this thing called ego, which separates me from God and separates me from everybody else. So when you remove God, and you then you become the individual. If you say that one consciousness is there in all and is in me, and that is functioning, then you do your same work. It's not that suddenly from an accountant you will become a priest. No. If you're an accountant, you will continue to work as an accountant, but you will be working with a higher goal, higher motive. How do we reduce this I and my, this selfishness? So they say there are three defects in the mind, three defects. One is impurity of the mind, selfishness, anger, hatred, jealousy, greed and all. That is one. Second is the agitation of the mind. The mind is always disturbed. And the third is ignorance. I don't know who I am, right? So there are three impurities in the mind. One is, there are three defects. One is impure mind, that is full of negative anger, hatred, greed, jealousy, selfishness. Second is, it is disturbed, very agitated. I sit for meditation and my mind runs in 1,000 places. And the third is, I don't know who I am, the ignorance. So they say, through service, through karma yoga, when you serve the world unselfishly, without I and mind, you say, I am a servant of the Lord has placed me here and I am here to serve the world. And whatever job you are doing, whether as a housewife or an engineer or a doctor or a clerk in the office or whatever job I am doing, working in the oil fields, I'm doing it as his work, doing it to the best of my ability and without I and my, and I'm here to serve the world. The more you do that, you remove the first defect, selfishness, anger, greed, jealousy. When I am serving the world, then automatically my selfishness, anger, greed will be reduced. Second defect of the mind is agitation or disturbance. So how do you reduce that? By constantly remembering the Lord. When you make your mind one-pointed and either center upon the Lord, as you see, as Jesus or Krishna, or you center upon the self, the Lord within, either case, your mind becomes very still and the world cannot disturb you. The world cannot bother you. The world cannot affect you. There's a very famous story of Buddha. Buddha, of course, didn't believe in God, but he always was centered within the self, God within. That's what he believed. he did not believe in idols or any extrinsic god. Unfortunately, they have maximum idols of Buddha all over the world. He never believed in idols, but that's beside the point. Anyway, so he believed that God is within, and he was always centered upon the self. So one day he was going with his, you know, with his monks who were his followers. And so about 20 or 30 of them were going, and they would go from one village to another, and they would, you know, people would feed them, and then Buddha would give discourses, and then slowly the monks who were learning also would then become teachers, and they would also go out and start teaching. So that was the idea. He was training them. So one place, as he was entering this village, this man comes and uses the most foul language for Buddha, calls him the worst words you can think of, or calls him all the worst bad names, insults him. And he goes on and on and on and on for half an hour, on and on, constant, doesn't stop. You guys are worthless, you guys are lazy, you don't work, you expect us to feed you, and you are on and on. And half an hour, 45 minutes, and Buddha was silent. By now, his monks couldn't take it. You know, there were about 30 of them, and they were all young, healthy men. And they said, "Master, you know, he has been cursing you and insulting you for 45 minutes, and you haven't said a word. Just give us one indication. Just tell us one time. We'll beat him so badly that he won't be able to recognize himself. You know, every bone in his body will break, because there are 30 of us and he's one. And we can beat him up. You know, how dare he insult?" Because for a student, guru is like God, you know. And my God, my guru is being insulted and called the worst names, worst possible. They couldn't take it finally. They said, "You know, we'll break his every bone in his body." Buddha said, "Look, he threw all these bad words and insults at me, right?" They said, "Yeah." He says, "But I didn't take them." So if he kept on, "But if I don't take them, then they still belong to him. I didn't take them." He could keep on saying, "But I didn't accept any of them. So if I don't accept it, he threw them to me, I didn't, and they are still his. But if you guys accepted it and took it, then go ahead and beat him up. But I didn't. So as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter." So a person who is centered upon that, you know, shamed all the, you know, his disciples, and they realized that the master was speaking from a highest level. The world can say anything, but if you are comfortable in your knowledge, and if you are centered upon the self or upon God, then the world cannot disturb you. So your mind will not be disturbed. Always at peace. That is number two. And the third is ignorance about who I am, and that is removed by constant self-inquiry. Who am I? We have talked about that many times, but we can repeat that by reading the Upanishads, by reading the books. They all tell us, scriptures tell us, through inquiry, through meditation, that I am not this body, mind, and intellect. They are my equipment. I use the body, mind, and intellect to work in the world, but I am that self. We all are. It's not that I am the self and you are all useless humans. No, we are all that one self, but we have forgotten that. So through constant inquiry, through listening to the scriptures, through listening to good teachers, and through meditation, you slowly free yourself from the ignorance and come to the understanding. And once you realize that, then you still continue to work, but your work becomes more divine. Then you become a saint or a prophet. Or even you may be an ordinary person. You may not become a saint. You may still be a doctor or engineer or lawyer or housewife. But every action of yours becomes divine, becomes a service of the world. So that is what happens. And then they say the knower of Brahman becomes Brahman. What does that mean? There is one entity called Brahman, you know, which is God all over, which is all pervading, which is everywhere. Everything is that. But I think myself to be separate from God. At this moment, all of us think, even I think, you know, I am not. How can I be that, you know, all powerful entity? Just as there is a drop of water, you know, rainwater, or there is a drop of water on your finger. As long as the water is on your finger, it will say, "I am a useless, limited drop of water." But if you take the finger on the ocean and drop the water in the ocean, what happens? it falls into the ocean and becomes one with the ocean. Then the water is no longer, the drop is no longer drop. It says, I am the ocean. The drop becomes the ocean, says, I am the ocean. So similarly, as long as this ego is there, I will say, I am this limited. But once I realize that I am that self, then it's not arrogance. It's not like I am God. It's not that I can create the world. It's not that. But I am that divinity, and everybody is that. So he says the self of one is the self of all. So everybody is nothing but that divinity, and we are all one. And there is actually only oneness. So that oneness comes, and then your limit, your finitude goes away. Then you say, I am not this limited individual. I am that divinity. So why should I let the small little things in the world bother me? If somebody insults me, somebody doesn't want to talk to me, if some physical discomfort comes, some health problem, it's okay. I am none of these. You know, it will happen. The nature of the body is it is meant to go, you know, go downhill. It will one day get old and die. So what? But I don't die. I was never born. So why will I die? So you conquer death. That's what they say. The person who realizes that becomes immortal. I actually am immortal. All of us are immortal because we were never born and we will never die. But temporarily, we have taken on this form called the body, and we have been given a name like Diana or, you know, Victor or whatever name and form I have been given. So whatever form I have been given, whatever role the director has assigned me in that play where he has put me, I perform that role to the best of my ability. And when it comes time to drop the role, like an actor, you know, he plays a part in a movie of Ben-Hur, and then next, you know, he's a Roman, and then the next movie he's a gangster. He doesn't hold on to that Roman. He doesn't wear Roman clothes and, you know, go into the city to become a gangster. He drops those and puts on a cap and a gun and a hood and all. Why? Because now he's a criminal. So he drops one role and picks another one up. So similarly, I drop one body, and when it's time to pick up, I pick up another one. So one, that such a person, A, goes beyond death. Secondly, he sees oneness, total unconditional love. That's what Jesus said, love thy neighbor as thyself. It doesn't matter who that neighbor is, whatever nationality, whatever race, whatever country. The idea neighbor means whoever is next to you. You know, it could be a neighbor sitting here, or it could be a neighbor in your house, or it could be a neighbor at work in the next cubicle. It could be a neighbor sitting in the bus with you or in the train. So the idea is that whoever is next to you, love them as thyself. And then the last question is, you know, that when we say ego, then does that mean that I should not love myself? People think, if I don't have an ego, then who will take care of me? And then maybe I shouldn't love myself, you know, because ego is like something bad or something wrong. You know, people always think ego means something bad. You shouldn't have an ego. It's edging God out and all those phrases. So the masters say that there is a difference between self-love and ego. When you say, I do not love myself, what you are doing is you are criticizing God that he somehow is inadequate or useless or worthless, so he created me. So if God created me, I am a divine creature created by him. So how can I be useless? So first of all, you should never hate yourself, never dislike yourself. Love yourself, because if you don't love yourself, how do you expect the world to love you? Love does not mean that you spend hours in front of a mirror, you know, or you're getting plastic surgery done or buying clothes. Love the self within. Love your true inner nature. Love who you are. They say, you know, but you don't know me. So why? I have committed so many faults. If you count the list of sinners, you know, my name will be up there, you know, in the top 10. I have made so many mistakes. I have done so many bad things. You know, nobody forgives me. I go to church and confess. So they say, yes, we all have faults. It's not that you alone have or you alone. We all have faults, you know, to varying degrees. But you first have to accept the fact that I have faults. And we all do. That's number one. You recognize that, okay, these are my deficiencies. This is where I have not done good in the past and I need to do better. So you first acknowledge them. Then you surrender to the Lord. You say, Lord, I am yours. Even good or bad, whatever faults I have, I am yours. I'm here to surrender to you. And then third thing is, you have to forgive yourself. See, we say, we go to church and say, God should forgive me, you know, and we go confess in the sins and all. But if I don't forgive myself, if I keep having the guilt, you know, I did so much bad in my life, I was in the past, you know, blah, blah, past. So what you do is, by forgiving, it does not mean that you go repeat the same mistakes. As I said, once you have realized that you have this fault, so you try to correct it, and you forgive yourself unconditionally and say, okay, I forgive you. It is myself, and forget. And when you surrender to the Lord and forgive and remove the guilt, because it is the guilt which hurts us more. Why do I not love myself? Because I have a lot of guilt. I have all this guilt trip. So reduce the guilt, accept yourself fully, surrender to the Lord, and then try to correct. And whatever mistakes I made, oh Lord, I apologize to you. If you can apologize to people you have hurt, you can do that. Or if the person is no longer in your life, mentally you say, oh Lord, take care of that individual. I hurt him accidentally or her. You know, let that, the Lord will let him take care of that. So once you accept yourself fully, then that is called self-love. Where I am a divine creature. I have been created by him. And he is perfect. How could he create an imperfect individual? It is through my vasanas, my selfish tendencies, that I have done all the negative things. So as I said, through the removing the three defects of the mind, you reduce your vasanas. And as you reduce them, you become more and more divine. So love yourself, and unconditionally, and forgive and forget. And also forgive and forget others. If somebody else has hurt you also, forgive that. Because the more you hold on to that, oh, you know, 5 years ago he told me that, I still can't forget it. It's okay, you know, let it be. Or if somebody did something, let the law of karma take care of him. Or there is a Lord above, he will take care. So when you forgive and forget, and you love yourself, that reduces the ego. So there is a difference between self-love and ego. There's a lot more we can talk about. I had to kind of shorten this, but I hope. I think you should all take a picture of this and then kind of go over it or listen to the talk when Tony puts it on the internet, because it's a difficult subject. There is a lot to be covered in this, but I'm sure there will be questions or comments about it. Did I answer your question? What is ego?
Well, we've been told what ego is, so I will not take notes for
it. I heard from one of the commentaries.
Wayne Dyer says that?
Oh, okay. Maybe. Because somebody had given that in a different commentary without mentioning. But maybe it come from him. Or could be, yeah. Okay. I just heard it recently. I had not heard this before when I was doing my research. Because a subject like that needs a lot of research. So I had to spend some time putting it together. And that's good, because when you have difficult questions like that, then it makes you think.
Ego becomes an operating system, I mean, just to take care of the body or love yourself.
No, the body is taken care of by the prarabdha, by its, you know, by the physiological systems. So he has a minimal amount of ego, and then the realized master functions in the world without ego. He has absolutely no ego. So what happens is, for such a person, he has no sense of doership, or I know. So he says the body, mind, and intellect are working. See, a person who is in the path of divine, of love, bhakti, you know, the path of divine love, he says God is working through me, I am a humble servant of the Lord. Then again, he has no ego. Or the person on the path of knowledge says, I am that consciousness. This body, mind, and intellect is functioning and doing its job, whatever. The body is supposed to work. The mind is supposed to feel, the intellect is supposed to decide. And so whatever activities are happening by the body, mind, and intellect, they are not mine. So, but that does not mean then that person has no, takes no responsibility. In fact, when he is centered upon the self, then he cannot but do good actions. It's not that if he has no responsibility, then tomorrow if his body kills somebody, doesn't mean he can say, oh, I did not kill because I am not, I am the self. No, he cannot kill because he is one with all. See, the self of one is the self of all. So when he becomes one with all, then he has all spontaneous love and sacrifice and you know, so he cannot even harm a fly. So his actions automatically become pure. And the body, mind and intellect continues to function and he has no ownership of that. He says they are doing it, their job. That's what in the Gita also he says, a person who is realized walking, talking, sneezing, eating, drinking, he says, I don't do anything. I don't do anything. The body is doing it. The body is eating, the mind is feeling, the intellect is thinking, but I don't do anything. Why? Because I am not the doer. So the doership is gone and such a person's actions automatically become divine. So he has no ego. If you're truly a realized master, you'll have no ego at all. Does not mean that he won't function in the world. He actually will function better because the ego is the obstacle which prevents us from doing a good job. When I and my come, then, you know, I did this and then it didn't go well. But I didn't do it. You know, it's happening. Then you work from a much higher level. Yes.
It seems so far is that the leaving the body aside, providing that it takes care of itself by its own internal system, then it seems that the mind, intellect, and the memories are working behind the scenes. And so, well, the word is there. It's
working.
Self-inquiry.
Right, self-inquiry. But the ego cannot be seen under a microscope. Whoever said he saw that is lying. Because ego actually has no real true existence. Ego is a phantom that we create in our mind. It cannot be seen under a microscope. So if somebody says, I saw the ego, I think the person is deluded, in my opinion. I mean, because ego is not something which has a, it does not have a physical existence that can be put under a microscope and seen. It is a phantom creation of our own mind. Ego is something we create and cannot be seen under a microscope. So whoever is talking, I have not read the article, either he is
metaphorically speaking, of course.
It's a way to say.
Huh?
It's just a way to say. It's a metaphor.
Yeah, metaphor. You cannot see it under a microscope. He can say that ego has different aspects. Sometime a child pops up, sometime an adult. And that I understand, but to say that I saw it under a microscope, to me that's dishonest. Because there is no such, can you see your ego? You can see your body, you cannot see the ego. The ego is actually, when you inquire into the ego, you find that it has no reality. Ego is a combination of the consciousness with the body. In between arises this phantom entity called ego. Body you can see. Consciousness is everywhere and you can experience it. You can become one with it. But the ego is a phantom creation of my mind. Cannot be put under a microscope because it does not have a physical existence. Only thing you can put under a microscope, you can put your hand under the microscope or a bacteria or a virus because they are physical entities. But ego cannot be. I'm sorry, but that's what my opinion is.
That must have been metaphorically.
Yeah.
No, if it's metaphorically, that's different if he's talking. But if he says, I saw it under a microscope, then I haven't read the article, so.
No, it's metaphorically speaking, mentioning the how we operate in transactions.
Yeah. No, that I understand. Yeah, okay, psychologically it can have different roles.
Yeah.
But it's not a physical entity. It's not a physiological or a physical entity. It is a creation of my mind. That's what I think. That's how all the authors describe the ego. As it's a bundle of memories. Past and future. Past memories and future hopes. Together they make this ego. You know, this creature called ego. But when you are in the present and when you are in the now and when you are inquiring, and the ego will very rapidly disappear. The ego does not like inquiry. If you start inquiring, who am I really this body? The moment you inquire, the ego doesn't like that. And the ego will try its best, you know, will try to get the mind disturbed. When you're sitting in meditation, it will say, you know, why are you wasting your time? Let's go and watch, you know, the news, you know, we need to know what happened. Or let's go have some coffee, you know, we're feeling sleepy. Or I'm tired, I didn't get enough sleep at night. Or, you know, I have so much work to do. And, you know, why am I sitting? So the ego does not like inquiry because it knows that once you inquire, the ego will die. Ego will disappear. In a wise person has no ego at all. You and I have an ego yet because we have not reached that state. But the more you go inward, the more you come closer to the self, the ego gets thinner. That's how you know you are evolving spiritually. But things that used to bother you don't bother you anymore. You don't have this, oh, I easily got hurt. You know, somebody said something. Like Buddha. You know, he has no ego. He can call me anything, but I am the self. So he said, you are insulting the body, but I am not the body. So you can keep saying anything you want. Because you are insulting the body, named Buddha, or the mind, or the intellect, but I am that. You cannot insult the self. So he doesn't take anything. So that is called lack of ego, where the person is not that he becomes a useless creature. Buddha was so productive that even 2,500 years after he's left this body, people still remember his teachings. We are talking about Buddha. Think about it. You know, I mean, 2,500 years ago he left, but we are still telling his stories. Jesus, people are still remembering because these people have no ego. They become one with God, one with that.
Then you have a problem if you push away ego.
People have this fear that if I give up this ego, I will lose my individuality. In fact, you become more, you know, you don't lose anything. You gain, like I sent everybody an email. Did you get it? What did I gain from meditation? He said, I gained nothing. Did everybody get that email? I don't know if she sent it or not. I had told her to send. It says, what did you gain from meditation? So the answer is, I gained nothing. Really, you gained nothing? Then why? What did you? He says, but I lost. What did I lose? I lost desire. I lost selfishness. I lost anger. I lost fear of death. I lost, you know, body. So you lose a lot. So you lose all these negative things. It does not mean that you become a useless creature. That's why we said you still love yourself. But your love for yourself increases because you become more and more divine. And your activities actually are more efficient. So does ego means the sense of doership, that I did it, I, me, mine, and all that. It does not mean that you give away tomorrow, you say, nothing is mine, so okay, you can come and take all my clothes and you give away your money or your house. That's not it. But the feeling that I did it, that goes away. The Lord is working through me. And that is the lack of ego. That is the doership is no longer there. You surrender everything to the higher. And such a person actually does a much better job than you and me, because you and me, we still work with I, me, and mine. But a person who has none of that, works as a servant of the Lord, an instrument, then becomes a Buddha or a Jesus, you know, or a Shankaracharya or a Swami Chinmayananda or like that. So they actually do much better job. It does not mean that you suddenly think that you will become useless. Actually, you will become even better. The more you are centered upon the self, the more you meditate and realize, the better your actions will be, more pure, will be more loving, will be more sharing, and will be more efficient. Because our energy is dispersed with the mind, saying, I, me, mine. Everything is his. He is working. Then your actions actually are more efficient. You can work with 3-4 hours sleep. Swami Chinmayananda used to sleep 3 hours at night. He would sleep 3 hours, 21 hours he would be working, answering letters. In those days they didn't have emails. He would personally answer all the letters of people, and he would be traveling all over the world giving talks, and 3 hours he slept. That's all. So they become very efficient instruments.